It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. What happens when a bunch of comedians get together to try and make each other laugh? I'm not sure, but I'm guessing it sounds a lot like the Comedy Bang Bang podcast. Now, how do you take a podcast of comedians cracking each other up and turn it into a laugh-out-loud book? We're going to get some answers with the host of Comedy Bang Bang, the podcast, who's also the editor of Comedy Bang Bang, the podcast, the book, which is out today. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of the podcast? Have you seen it live? Do you have a favorite guest performer or character or moment from the podcast or the TV show? And do you have questions about what it takes to put it all together? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Scott Aukerman is the center of the Comedy Bang Bang extended universe. His popular podcast started as a radio show in 2009. The TV show ran for 5 seasons on IFC, just one C. Scott is also a 2-time Emmy winner as the co-creator and director of Between Two Ferns with Zach Galifianakis. Now he's the editor of the book that is again out today, Comedy Bang Bang, the podcast, the book. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. And I just want to announce that I am donating $100 million to WPR, and I know that are you going to match that?
I'm not. What I hear, but I got to let you know, this is maybe awkward. That is a legally binding statement, Scott, under state and federal law.
Well,
so I hope that podcast is doing real good. You got to sell a lot of books.
Thankfully, I'm not in Wisconsin right now, and will not be traveling back there.
Oh, we'll find you, my friend. Now, for people who haven't seen the podcast, Comedy Bang Bang, now, I think I get it, but I have a hard time describing it to people. What's your elevator pitch to that person who hasn't heard it yet?
It's pretty simple. It's a podcast where I'm the host, and I have celebrities on, celebrities like Alan Scott or... did I say Alan Scott? I meant Adam Scott.
Adam.
Easy mistake to make when you're talking to him. or Andy Samberg, you know, comedians basically. And then I have other comedians on playing fake people. So they're playing characters. So they're playing people like Cal Solomon, who was there when rap was invented. But he's an older white gentleman who could never quite make it. Or sometimes they're playing impressions of celebrities like Andrew Lloyd Webber, the musical theater composer. So it's a weird mix of actual celebrities who are being forced to talk to fake people and find out a little bit more about them.
Now, something I'm curious about, if I'm a celebrity, and I'm not, but if I went on like a late night talk show as a celebrity, my agents are going to negotiate. Yeah, you got to plug the movie. Ask about this funny anecdote. Don't ask about the illegal gambling ring in international waters, that kind of stuff. Celebrities going on Comedy Bang Bang, the podcast. I think there's a different set of expectations. How does that work?
Yeah, I think celebrities come on to plug their movies and their television shows. But, you know, it's just more fun for them to do my show because they get to relax. They don't have to talk about themselves forever and ever. And they get to interact with really funny people. I think every celebrity comes into it maybe with a little bit of trepidation, but they leave saying it was one of the most fun things they've done.
Now, you're taking that and putting it in book form. And it seems like, you know, you're not like transcribing moments from the podcast here. It seems like you try to capture, I guess, the spirit of the show in book form. How does that work?
Well, we wanted to do something really funny that hasn't been done on the show. So like you say, a lot of comedy books or podcast books are just transcriptions of previous episodes. And we didn't really want to do that. We wanted to basically do something new that would be really great for the fans, but also be great for people who have never heard the show before. So what we did was we took all of these comedians who play these really great characters who have been on, some of the characters have been on for over a decade at this point. And we had them create new things for the book. So, for instance, there's a character that Andy Daly plays called Dalton Wilcox, who is a cowboy poet. And we had him write some new poems for the book. There's a game that we play when Andy Samberg is on the show called Hollywood Facts, which is all about trivia. And so we have a whole board game for Hollywood Facts where it's like a Trivial Pursuit board game where we wrote a whole bunch of admittedly joke questions for it. It's just a huge compendium of art and posters and lists and articles and strange ephemera that have been created by all of these brilliant comedians who are doing characters.
Now, you mentioned the Cowboy Dalton Wilcox. We have a clip from your latest podcast, which I believe was a live show version of the podcast focused on the book. I'm losing track here, but here's Jason Mantzoukas, Paul F. Tompkins, and Andy Daly as the Cowboy Dalton Wilcox talking about the new book.
What's incredibly generous about that, and I will say, you've admitted to stealing this, but in doing so, you've given an incredible gift to Dalton. Dalton, you must be excited you got the $15,000 that we all got to write pieces for the book.
I beg your pardon?
I'm sorry. Every contributor got $15,000.
Son of a I even got $15,000. I'm not in the book.
What? He's just a new guy. When I think of all
this is my only appearance.
Really?
Yes. When I think of all the jerky I could buy for $15,000, I could fill my jerky vault again. It's almost empty.
All right, besides stealing money from the poor cowboy, can you talk about what it's like to wrangle this cast of dozens of performers on the podcast and then in the book?
Yeah, you know, on the podcast, I try to make sure that I don't know what anyone is going to be talking about. So if anyone ever tries to tell me what their character is all about or what their bit is that day, I shut it down and I say, let's just talk about it on the show, because I think discovery is such an interesting part of the show and making each other laugh in the moment is so great. So my role on the show is just kind of a ringmaster who's just sitting there trying to get the information out of everyone in the funniest possible way. So when it came to the book, that was what I just tried to do, was I would pitch ideas to the comedians and say, like, hey, what if, you know, your character did this idea? And it worked out really great. I mean, the book is just, you know, it has over 50 contributors and there's just so many incredibly funny pieces. And I think if you're really into comedy, it's something that you'd love.
Talking to Scott Aukerman, host of Comedy Bang Bang, the podcast, editor of the brand new book, Comedy Bang Bang, the podcast, the book. Let's bring out a caller at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a number of friends that are comedians and just guys sitting around that riff. And what I find is what happens is the guys get dirtier and dirtier and dirtier, vulgar, the most anti-woke, trying to one-up the next guy. My question is, you know, it used to be, you know, conservative Republicans would always be the ones that tried to shut people down. Now it seems to be the left that is trying to shut down, the, you know, this anti-woke stuff. Wondering how that has impacted your comedy.
Steve, thanks for the call. Scott, I don't know if you get into woke and anti-woke in the podcast or the book. Some of the material is a little salty, R-ish rated. I don't know. Do you have thoughts for Steve?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think personally, I feel like the podcast is very silly. I know what people mean when they say that, you know, like people try to one-up each other and stuff. And we as comedians are trying to one-up each other, but it's a very silly show where people are doing funny voices. And so, yeah, some of the material is salty. And the aforementioned Dalton Wilcox is a cowboy who essentially is a lonely cowboy out on the range and finds various ways to cope with his loneliness, if you know what I mean, in a very graphic manner.
Don't.
But at the same time, we're being very silly. And, you know, we're not going after targets or anything like that other than just trying to make people laugh in a very funny way.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Got another clip here. Comedian Jason Mantzoukas. Now, this gets meta all over the place. Now, he's a real-life comedian, but he claims to be actually a character being played by the actor Jeffrey Character Wheaties. Here's a bit of, I guess, the two of you in your most recent episode.
I get a video from you. This guy's cut himself into the Fast and Furious trailer. This guy falls for every studio's dumb promo.
I'm a character in it. I'm Oxcord.
Oxcord.
That's me driving.
What car do you think you would drive? If you were in the Fast and Furious,
1995 Hyundai.
So I think there's a taste of some of the silliness you were talking about there, Scott. I don't know. Where does that silliness come from for you guys? How do you keep building on each other like that?
You know, that's one of the greatest parts. When I started doing comedy back in the 90s, I started in 1995, and I went on to work on a show called Mr. Show with Bob Odenkirk and David Cross. That was one of the joys of being in the business to me, was the fact that every day you'd go to work and you'd make each other laugh all day. And, you know, a lot of that would get into the work that you did, but a lot of it just was in the room. And I think that's what's so great about podcasting, is a bunch of friends can get in a room, and they're really funny people, and they just build on top of each other. And the only goal is to just have fun. And I think that's the thing with our show, is it's about fun. It's not about like being the most clever or being the most biting or the most witty. It's just about having fun with each other. And I think the audience can really hear that.
It's funny you mentioned Mr. Show, because your podcast and the book remind me of one very particular thing. I remember watching Mr. Show on the DVD, but watching the commentary track. And it's the actors talking about, you know, the sketches in character, but then other characters of theirs would show up and talk to each other about the show on the screen. And that had a kind of the same feel to me of, you know, your real actors and your real celebrities, but then, you know, somebody might be a character too. Do you harken back to some of that Mr. Show time in this new podcast, or in the new podcast and the book?
Oh yeah. I mean, I loved working with Bob and David. They were so fun. And, you know, I was there for the recording of those commentary tracks. And I think, you know,
I was
TV
the nerd
version,
who watched it. Yeah.
I mean, I watched them at home too. So, you know, I'm the nerd as well. But I mean, for the commentary tracks for the Comedy Bang Bang TV show, we would do, you know, something very similar, where we would have the characters that I was interviewing actually doing the commentary. And I found we would get into the same conversations that we were having on the screen a lot of the time. So I don't know. It's to me, that's the fun part of being in the comedy business, is the making each other laugh, the being silly. And that's what podcasting can really bring to the audience, is they're right there in the room while we're doing this.
And Scott, as we wrap up, I know you take the show on the road sometimes. You've brought it to Wisconsin in the past. Any thoughts on coming back here and us collecting on that pledge you made earlier?
I mean, you'd have to catch me. I'm going to be dancing between the raindrops when I'm out there. But yeah, I would love to come back to Wisconsin. I lived in Milwaukee for a bit.
Oh.
It's a really, really great town and a wonderful state. And I would love to be back whenever we go on tour again.
Fantastic. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Scott Aukerman, host of Comedy Bang Bang, the podcast, and editor of the new book we've been talking about, Comedy Bang Bang, the podcast, the book. We've been talking about what makes us laugh, who makes us laugh, and why, and how they pull together this podcast. Want to hear from you at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 with your gift. We'll tell you more about that in just a minute. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. When was the last time you tried to learn a new skill or try to get good at something you've always been really bad at? It can be incredibly frustrating to try and fail over and over again. Sometimes it's hard to see your own progress along the way. Often many of us give up and never accomplish that thing we really wanted to do. Our next guest documented that journey for himself to try and understand why it's so hard to master skills, and he shares the lessons he learned along the way from the masters he worked with. Adam Gopnik is an author and staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book is called The Real Work on the Mystery of Mastery. I talked to him earlier today. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Delighted to be with you.
I want to talk about this concept that comes from the world of magicians, and it's the title of your book. What do we mean by the real work when it comes to mastering something?
So I was out in Las Vegas with my then 13-year-old son, who was obsessed with card magic, and he and his wonderful teacher, a great irascible sleight of hand man named Jamie Ian Swiss, were in Las Vegas, and I trailed them. And if you've never trailed your 13-year-old son to Las Vegas to meet with magicians, you haven't really lived. And late at night, when the magicians were all together talking their beautiful shop talk, they would kind of grumble to each other, mumble to each other. Hey, who's got the real work on that? Who's got the real work on that? Floss was illusion. Who's got the real work on that? I didn't know what the term meant. And I listened and studied, learned the way you do when you're entering into a new world. And I realized over time that what magicians mean by the real work is not who has the greatest technical virtuosity with a trick or an illusion, nor who presents it in the most sensational way. No, what they mean is who's got maximal technical virtuosity, but combines it with a kind of empathetic engagement with the audience. They know what the audience is thinking before the audience knows and can play with their expectations. Because as every magician will tell you, you don't do magic with your fingers alone, you do it with your mind. And as soon as I had that concept, understood what the real work was, I knew that it was a, what's the right word, a transitive idea, one that you could apply to almost any area of creative work, artisanal work, anything that human beings struggle to learn to do.
Now, the tricky bit is getting from here to there, here being, I don't know how that's done, to having that kind of, yep, of mastery through the real work. And you, through a lot of different experiences, tried to break down that concept and figure out how to apply it. Before we get to specifics, like for somebody trying something new, how can they take that concept of real work and try to use it to learn that new thing, whatever it might be?
It's surprisingly simple, almost ridiculously simple. I dove into, as you said, I dove into drawing and boxing and driving, which I had to learn to do in my mid-50s, and dancing and baking. And what they all have in common is that it, the real work comes when you break an activity or an enterprise, a skill, an art, down into its component steps, which are often not at all obvious. They're very often counterintuitive. And then you take all these stubborn little counterintuitive steps. Dancing itself is a perfect example of it, right? You learn steps. You don't learn how to dance. But over time, those stumbling steps somehow, and this is the extraordinary human part of it, they seem almost to assemble themselves. If you pursue them with enough passionate perseverance, they assemble themselves into the illusion of a seamless whole. And suddenly you're not stumbling, you're dancing. Suddenly you're not stabbing at the paper, you're drawing. Suddenly you're not just looking at the pattern, you're actually sewing a dress. And that's the way it always happens. You break it down, you instill it inside yourself. It's painful, you persevere, and suddenly it happens.
Adam, that reminds me of a quote I liked enough to jot it down. While you were learning boxing and taking dance lessons and finding similarities between the two, here's the quote: if you surrender to allow the simple pattern to imprint itself on your mind, an inordinate gift will blossom. At least that is the promise of mastery. Can you talk about that moment of realization when that simple pattern that didn't even necessarily feel like dancing turned into, hey, I'm dancing here?
Yeah, I put it better there than when I'm speaking. That's why I'm a writer, not a motivational speaker. But yeah, you know, I like to call it the cognitive opiate that we make for ourselves. That as we're persevering, suddenly the moment, sometimes psychologists call it the flow. I like to call it simply happiness, because happiness is always an absorption in something outside ourselves, where we get totally absorbed in something outside ourselves, and suddenly we're not thinking about it anymore, and we realize in retrospect that we were uniquely happy. That moment of the flow, absorption of happiness, just comes on, but it only comes on if you persevere in all the stumbling, awkward steps for long enough. But the great thing is it doesn't have to be that long, because you register improvement. When I was boxing, and you cannot imagine anyone on the planet who was less well-suited to be a boxer than I am.
I give you pretty good competition in that one, I feel like. Not in the boxing itself, but being awkward about it.
You know, if I'm ever actually going to get in the ring, it'll have to be with another 5'5", 66-year-old writer who's been practicing a sedentary occupation. It'll be, you know, the battle of the Jewish intellectuals. But I love the art of boxing, the science of boxing, because it's about choreographing a set number of punches, jab, jab, cross, uppercut, slip, jab, cross. And as you put those together, at first very awkwardly, you do get better. You do get better. And suddenly they start to become this seamless sequence. And at that moment when they do, however awkwardly they might still look to someone who actually is a good boxer, the charge you get inside is so enormous that it buoys you up like nothing else.
Talking to Adam Gopnik about his new book, The Real Work, on the Mystery of Mastery. Adam, I'm going to throw another one of your quotes in here.
earlier in the process, that is something we got to get over, I think, if we're going to learn something. You're writing here about learning to draw and doing it badly, as I would.
Very bad.
Quoting, I was filled with feelings of helplessness and stupidity and impotence that I had not experienced since elementary school. Why was I so unable to do something so painfully simple? Adam, this really spoke to me. I immediately was taken back to foreign language classes where I felt exactly what you describe. How do we get through that to as you say, persevere?
I still struggle with Italian in exactly that way. It drives me nuts.
Like little kids can speak these languages and I can't.
Yes, little Italian kids speak it perfectly and we can't. The answer to that is partly the obvious one. You want a goal, right? I wanted to learn to draw because I'd spent 40 years as an art critic and didn't know how to draw. And that seemed to me kind of marginally shameful. You can make a perfectly reasonable case that you don't have to be a great draftsman to be a good art critic anymore than you have to be able to hit 100-mile-per-hour fastball to be a sports writer. But it helps you if you internalize some of the task that the people who are good at it face every day. But the way you get past those moments of absolutely tearful impotence, feeling the impossibility, is partly having a goal. You want to get it done. But it's also partly because you begin to become fascinated with the little stubborn parts. I was dancing. I learned dancing, formal dancing with my daughter. And just the two of us struggling to get the basic steps of the foxtrot right brought a kind of intimacy between us. We were having a much deeper conversation in dancing badly than we might have had in talking skillfully, as we both can. So it's both sticking to the goal, why you wanted to do it, but it's also loving the process and finding another person, particularly in the process. That's kind of one of the lessons that comes up again and again in the book.
Another theme that goes through the book is the idea of achievement versus accomplishment. Can you compare and contrast what you mean by those?
Yeah, it's a distinction I've been struggling sometimes to explain to people. By achievement, I simply mean all of the things that are imposed in us, and particularly on our kids, from outside, the grade you've got to get, the college you're supposed to get into, the next task you're supposed to do. It's sort of like running a rat maze where you're always turning a corner, getting a shot of sugar water and being sent off to the next thing. We live in an achievement-driven society that forces our kids and ourselves into that kind of achievement. By accomplishment, I mean the things we choose to do most often by ourselves and for ourselves, the things that just fascinate us and that we enclose ourselves in. I'm sure you've had this experience. When I was 12 years old, I locked myself in my bedroom with a $40 guitar and a big book of Beatles songs, and I forced my fingers to form C chord, D chord, G chord, the simplest chords that there are. And it was just weeks of pressing my fingers and watching them bleed. But when I was done, I had a kind of sense of accomplishment that I have never had at any other time in my life. And everything I've done since is built on the pedestal of that sense of accomplishment, because it brings with it a sense of possibility, and at an even deeper level, a sense of self, a sense of who you are and what you're capable of.
I want to talk about how we set expectations if we're trying to master something. I, in the last handful of years, took some swimming lessons. I could kind of swim. I got a little better. I'm never going to be on somebody's swim team. I'm never going to win a medal. But when it hit me like, hey, I'm doing laps here. I've swallowed less than a gallon of water. I'm not having to stop and wheeze for, 20 minutes between each length. That was an accomplishment for me. When we set out to master something, how do we sort of get that concept of what is a winning state? What is an accomplishing state for me?
Yeah, that's exactly it. That was an accomplishment, not an achievement.
Exactly.
You weren't winning a swim race. You weren't going to get a medal.
Nope.
But it was a profound sense of accomplishment. Well, the great thing about it is that our minds and bodies seem kind of geared, sent from the factory, wanting to have that experience. And the other great thing about it is it only gets more rewarding as life goes on. When we're younger, we have to choose something. And one of these accomplishments, we hope, will become a vocation, something that we can do through life. But then as time goes on, the thing that we're good at, in my experience, we're only able to experience as disappointment, because we see the difference between the scale of our ambitions and the scale of our accomplishments. Other people, we hope, will see the scale of our accomplishments.
And Adam, you accomplished so many things in the book. Do you have your set sight on a new accomplishment that you want to tackle?
Absolutely. That's why accomplishment and achievement, a little subtle, right? Remembering, but yes, There are two that are very much on my mind. I'd love to learn to sing. I write music, and I write particularly lyrics and librettos, and I'd like to be able to deliver my own songs with authority. And the other is, you'll be glad to know, speak Italian. I love Italian culture. I love Italian food. I have been to Italy a few times, and I still feel shamefaced because when I order wild strawberries, I get green beans. And I am determined to fix that and keep my kids from laughing next time we're there.
Adam, arrivederci, and thanks for joining us today.
Ah, is that Italian? Arrivederci.
I think so.
Adam Gopnik is a staff writer for New Yorker. He was with us today to share his new book. It's called The Real Work on the Mystery of Mastery.